The meeting will come to order. I would entertain a minute. We do have a quorum, so I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes for the January 16th meeting.
So moved.
Representative Morrow moves approval of the minutes for yesterday's meeting. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. And now we will go to the agenda, which we are now going to hear from the pros in the legislature, the governmental relations people, the lobbyists for the major education groups. And a really good lobbyist, when they come to your office, can tell you what they're for and what their organization is all about in a very short time. And I like just-in-time information. When people come in and tell you what they really want you to know, and there's nobody that we all like better when we're so crammed with our agendas than somebody who's scheduled for 15 minutes and they come in and they take only five. And then you've got 10 minutes to do your emails and things like that. Well, today we are going to put them all to the test because each one of them has 3 minutes. And we're, in order to be fair to the people at the end of the list, some of whom have actually requested to be the end of the list because they're skirting meetings with the Senate as well, we have to stick to that 3 minutes. So I will be a taskmaster. And the first, and so if you could, if you do, everybody has the agenda, if you could see who, you know, get right up to the front row. And first we've got Jim Bartholomew, then Jan Allswager, Mary Ciccone. If you could, Jim, come up to the table and the others do what Mary's doing, get right up in the front row so we can not waste time in between.
Yeah, all good.
And I'm not going to introduce anybody. I'll let you introduce yourselves. And some people have handouts. We've asked them to talk about their top priority and is there any way to tie it into the achievement gap, since that was our big topic for the session. Welcome, Jim Bartholomew. Please identify yourself and you get to set an example for everybody else.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And my name is Jim Bartholomew. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I do want to thank Chair Greiling and the committee for the opportunity to visit with you, just to talk about the quick who we are and how it relates to the achievement gap. Sending out a one-pager, because I'm notoriously long-winded and I'll miss something, I'm sure. But the Business Partnership is an organization of slightly more than 100 of the CEOs of some of Minnesota's largest companies. And they were started in 1977, and our two main issues have always been K-12 education and state fiscal policies. And the reason we've always focused on education is because a quality education is central to an educated citizenry, which is vital to both our economic survival as a state and prosperity, as well as the ability of individuals to be active and engaged citizens. So K-12 education has just been a fundamental issue for us since our inception. When we look at putting together education policies, primarily for you and others, we try to follow four principles. And those are at the top of the one pager. And basically it sets up that we think it's appropriate for the state to set the expectations for what high school graduates need to know and be able to do when they graduate, to be appropriately prepared for the next level, whether it's post-secondary education or the world of work. And those standards are the same for all students. Everybody needs to get to this level. We also then have a principle that we should measure and report student and school progress towards those expectations. Let people know how we're doing. That allows you to identify best practices and target where more assistance may be needed. We also think it's important to give educators as much flexibility as possible in trying to design educational programs and services that they think will best meet student needs. So in the sense that the state has an appropriate role to set the expectations, measure progress, and then, by and large, with all due respect, the state should let educators and local school boards figure out how best to get there. And kind of in that same vein, parents should have as many options as possible to find the school setting that works best for their children. So those are kind of our four principles. And I'll bet I'm down to about a minute, so I'll just run really quick. On the legislative side of things, and I hope to get to visit with all of you soon, we would encourage you to look and I think approve the revised math standards as those come through from the Department of Education. We've supported the inclusion of a growth model in our accountability system, but there are many ways to do growth and value added, and in a nutshell, we hope that if you do that, that you maintain the same expectations for all students within a grade level standard context. If students start behind and they only need to make a year's worth of progress, for example, they'll end behind as well. But that's a long and complicated topic. And then online learning, I think that's a way to ensure our schools and districts have a variety of have access to a broad array of programs and courses.
You have and like 20 seconds.
I'll just finish up. Not all we do is legislative. We've really begun to become more engaged in non-legislative activities, mentoring through MVP Connections, our Minnesota Futures Awards, trying to recognize high-performing, high-poverty schools, the math standards, the power of you. Our main focus is making sure that we can raise the achievement level of all students, but it's absolutely imperative that we close the achievement gap, too. There are urban cities around this country, Detroit, Chicago, where it kind of looks like a donut. Growth and the prosperity is in the suburbs and the urban core is not so prosperous. And we cannot allow that to happen here.
Thank you very much. Jan Allsweiger. Welcome. And Renee Laura.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jan Allsweiger, and I represent Education Minnesota. It's an organization of 70,000 members. And for those of you who are not familiar with us, we are the first state that merged in the country. We are a merger of the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association. Our members include teachers and education support professionals in the K-12 system, early childhood teachers, and also the faculty in the two-year college system. I will go through these very quickly after I introduce my new colleague. His name is Renee Laura. He comes from the Texas Federation of Teachers and was there for 10 years, and I'm thrilled to have him here to work with me by my side.
Howdy.
And he's ready to hit the ground running. So, okay, I'm going to go through these items really quickly. First of all, funding is very important. Early childhood, K-12, and higher ed. We have been around the state doing 16 legislative forums. Soon we'll be done with them, and I'm getting tired, and so is Renee. And thank you for those of you who attended them. And early childhood, you know that with the cuts that we've had, we are now in 2006 back to the level that we were in 2001. We need significant funding in early childhood. Quick K-12, we're hearing about course cuts. We're not offering world-class opportunities when we are cutting world languages. We are cutting the essential courses that we should have for our kids. We hear social studies teachers saying that they have had to skip two course curriculum review cycles and haven't been able to order those textbooks because they have no money. We're not even at a nationwide standard right now. Higher ed, double-digit increases. Going back to K-12, do you know that we are 49th in the country in technology? If you want to talk about online learning, let's get some technology in our schools. All-day, everyday kindergarten is also a priority for our members. We know that this is one very good way to close the achievement gap, and we suggest that you have voluntary all-day kindergarten in every single school district. And another very important issue that you have heard before you in a number of years is statewide health insurance for school employees, and I am very happy and thrilled that we are now starting to break through. And people are starting to get to the truth about what we are trying to do. This is not a power grab for Education Minnesota. I have a whole list of myths. It will not cost school districts more. They will still get to negotiate at the local level how much they contribute, who is eligible for the insurance, which plan they offer. There will be 6 plans. It is a good way to have reform and tax efficiency. And so we look forward to working with you. We will continue to work to maintain licensure standards and everything else that is good for the students in Minnesota.
Thank you. You finished 15 seconds early. Good stars for you. Mary Ciccone.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mary Ciccone, and I'm with a group called Parents United for Public School. We're very simple. We unapologetically advocate for Minnesota's public schools. That's it. That's what we do. We advocate at an E16 level. We do most of our policy work here in K-12. What we try and do is link parents with the policy that you pass and how that affects their local schools. We're a young organization, yet I want you to know that we have contacts in 130 out of 134 legislative districts across the state. We have always been supportive of sustainable, dependable, and sufficient funds for our kids to be able to achieve all of the standards that you and the federal government put into play. Because of that, we are absolutely 100% behind PS Minnesota. We know it's rationally linked to student learning, and we know that it is research-based. That's always been our intent. Thank you.
Thank you. Peggy Smith.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Peggy Smith. I'm the State Legislative Chair for Minnesota PTA. And as most of you know, we're affiliated with the National PTA, which is an organization that was founded in 1897 and grew out of the founders' desire to promote the well-being of all children. And it was a time when child labor laws were few and far between, and accessibility to schools was by no means universal and limited. Our mission from the beginning was to promote a partnership of parents and teachers and cooperation between schools and home, as well as promote parent education. And as early as 1898, we focused on the importance of fathers being involved as well in rearing their children. We are not only focused on school funding, public schools, support of public schools, but also health and well-being issues as well. This year, our top priorities are supporting the PS Minnesota funding framework, the parent involvement law modeled on the National PTA standards of parent involvement, and passage of a universal health care bill for all children, reinstatement, and fourthly, reinstatement of physical education and health education requirements as part of the grad standards, which we have been working on for the past 3 years, supporting the work of the Heart Association. As far as the PS Minnesota framework is, how does that translate into reducing the achievement gap? Level of funding commensurate with higher standards and expectations that we have in Minnesota as a result of NCLB and standards-based reform. One of the principles of the PS Minnesota framework, a good funding formula, should account for differences in individual students, such as family wealth, family language, and special needs. We've long supported the idea in Minnesota PTA that it shouldn't matter where you live or go to school, whether it's Black Duck, Edina, or Minneapolis. Everybody, all students should have a well-rounded quality education, which will prepare them for post-secondary school. We also support, an important part of this is we support a limit on the operating referenda, and think that that has a lot to do with leveling the playing field between wealthy and poor districts and thereby contributing to a reduction in the achievement gap.
30 seconds.
Okay, thank you. I will only say that the peer involvement law that we would like to see implemented, passed and implemented, is based on research, PTA's 30 years of research working with researchers, and we want to promote meaningful parent and family participation in children's education, raise awareness regarding the components of effective parent involvement programs. So,
thank you very much. Ray Schwab. I did come from the League of Women Voters, so this timing thing I have down. Welcome. Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. Today with me, I've got my associate, Kirk Schneiderwin, in the back. I'll let you just wave with him. And oftentimes, you'll find an older gentleman who sometimes has a scowl on his face. His name is Tom Deans, and he's my attorney that you'll find often in this committee. MSBA, I gave you a blue packet that gives you an idea of the services we provide to services as a private nonprofit organization that provides technical assistance, cost-saving programs, advocacy training, research, and referral for all Minnesota public schools. Membership is voluntary, and we represent all Minnesota public school districts, including Minute Charter Schools. MSBA was founded in 1920. On an average year, we take about 28,000 calls from our member districts and put about 60,000 miles on our vehicles traveling around the state. We have 22 staff people, and we have 12 board of director members. Our goals for this legislative session, we've got a legislative position with children on the front. We are established by our delegate assembly. They are locally elected school board members by their peers that go on to, as a statewide convention, have about 100 people who vote on resolutions that we bring forward to you. For student achievement, MSBA supports all day, every day, optional kindergarten. We support additional funding for early childhood. We support funding for concurrent enrollment in college and the school programs. And also, we are looking for extended time revenue to be taken back up to the 1.5 rating and a base of 4,601 be raised. That's all I have, Madam Chairman, and I look forward to seeing Education Minnesota's health care plan. We usually have differing views about that, so I'll be excited to see the new proposal.
It's Thank always you, exciting when you are here with Education Minnesota.
We have a good time. Thank you, Madam
Chairman. Sam Walsh.
Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Sam Walseth, newly appointed Director of Legislative Action for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. For those of you who have been around a little while, you're probably a little more familiar with Vernay Hasbargen. I'm going to be stepping in and doing some more duties for MREA this session. Sorry about that. MREA is an organization governed by teachers, administrators, school board members, and pretty much anybody and everyone out in greater Minnesota who wants to have a say in rural education. Our membership is about 150 rural school districts, and while that sounds like an immense amount of school districts, I think we have represent probably the fewest number of actual students. Some of our members are districts that face severe decline in enrollment. I think some of our most geographically sparse districts over the last 5 years have lost upwards around 10 to 20% of their student body. So some pretty significant challenges out there for rural students. I'm handing out, or I shouldn't say I am, your staff is handing out a little card. And on one side is the student pyramid, not the food pyramid, but the student pyramid. And on the back is a checklist of the priorities and agenda items for MREA this session. And as we're talking about this, closing the achievement gap, we decided to put our learners first. That's how we govern our organization. And at the top of our checklist here is giving the students tools to be successful in life. And you're going to hear a lot of the same themes about investing in all-day, everyday kindergarten and other early childhood programs to give some of those most at-risk students a leg up as they enter kindergarten and and get on their way into elementary school. Measuring individual student growth to improve achievement. We think this is a more rational way to actually measure student growth and a better tool for teachers and administrators to work with their students so they know how those individual kids are doing in their classrooms. Guaranteeing highly qualified teachers. This is a challenge for rural Minnesota, and we have it on our platform. We really need to be able to offer competitive compensation packages for our teachers to draw teachers out into the hinterland. We don't always have all the amenities out in greater Minnesota, so we do need to keep a focus on that. The next item is technology. Technology is going to become an even more important factor in rural education. We're not talking about getting rid of teachers and having kids just stare blankly at TV screens. But when you start talking about Internet access and Internet 2 and some of the things that can deliver some of the curriculum that we can't necessarily afford to offer in every one of our individual sites, online technology and online learning are going to be options that we really need to look at for keeping our rural schools viable into the future. And lastly, meeting funding commitments. MREA has been a part of the PS Minnesota Coalition for the last couple of years, working with the John Myers funding study, and we need to start to recognize the inadequacy we have in our current funding system with the expectations of student standards and the shift from not just 100% participation in schools, but the expectation of 100% achievement by all students in our schools. And so we really need to start talking about adequate resources for our school systems. Lastly, I would be totally remiss if I didn't talk about equity. For rural schools, equity is a fundamental principle. In fact, I think it's one of the guiding principles that got MREA off the ground in the first place. And this session, we really want to take a look at and possibly in the tax committee, looking at some of the equalization factors for our various school levy programs. Most of those have been held flat for the last decade or so, and the state partnership with some of our school levies has really been diminished. So we really want to take a look at that. Madam Chair, that's a quick run through our agenda. I think I'll stop with that.
Thank you very much. Scott Kroonquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and you should have this handout, I believe, in your packet, mm-hmm. our platform. Madam Chair, AMSD represents 30 school districts in the Seven County metropolitan area. We have been in existence since 1974, and as you will note by looking at a list of our members, it really is a diverse group ranging from the two urban centers to the inner ring suburbs to outer ring suburbs. Our board, Madam Chair, members really used the very question you're asking today when developing our platform, how to eliminate the achievement gap. And as you'll notice, our topics and our platform really surround that topic. Our board believes, first and foremost, that we really need to modernize the funding formula. And we recommend using the work of the PS Minnesota Committee, or that was commissioned by the PS Minnesota Group, and you've heard about that already. But we think that report provides you with some excellent information with a roadmap on how to really enhance the formula in terms of modernizing it, recognizing the cost differentials that exist between different students and also different school districts. Number two is fixing the special education funding formula. I think you all know that this really is the 800-pound gorilla of school finance, and it is having a tremendous burden on our schools. If according to reports from the Department of Education, if nothing's done in this biennium, by fiscal year 2009, the special education cross-subsidy will reach $633 million. So it's a staggering amount. It's hard to even get your hands around that figure. And it's hard to talk about improving the achievement, reducing the achievement gap when you're spending that kind of money from your general fund on mandated special education programs. Number three, it's a topic you're all very familiar with, but that's getting at the early learners. It's investing in pre-K and in voluntary full-day kindergarten. And I won't spend more time on that because that's a topic you're all very familiar with. Our fourth item, as you can see, is attracting and retaining high-quality teachers. Research indicates that the single biggest factor in increasing student achievement, other than parental involvement, is the quality of the teacher in the classroom. And we outline a number of recommendations all the way from creating incentives to recruit and prepare teachers in high-needs areas to trying to do some streamlining in the QCOMP area to make sure that that program is applied evenly and that all applications are evaluated evenly. And just doing some fine-tuning of that program. Finally, I think this is, maybe is one area that hasn't been touched on, and that is trying to maintain local control and reduce some mandates in education. We think we can free up staff time to allow them to focus more on eliminating the achievement gap if we would get rid of some of the current reporting requirements and other bureaucratic inefficiencies that are in the system. I'll stop with that, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Ann McInerney. And I just realized I skipped Charlie Kite, so that's why Ann is running up here so fast. So you're next, Charlie.
I thought I had three more minutes.
Yes, you did. My mistake.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann McInerney, and I'm here today representing the Student Services Coalition for Effective Education. We are a coalition of student support personnel in the schools, which includes school social workers, school counselors, school psychologists, school nurses, and chemical health specialists who work in the schools. And even though all of our organizations have their own individual legislative agenda, our goal as a whole coalition is to provide student support services which enhance academic achievement and promote safe schools. To that end, we provide a full spectrum of services based on our licenses, ranging from counseling to promoting safe schools and healthy living, physical health, and safety. As you can imagine, each of our professions has a unique skill set and training. We feel that every child should have access to each of our services within the school system, that because no one profession is a catch-all for all students that will meet all of their needs. We are currently working on a task force to improve student access to student support services. The goal of the task force is to make recommendations to improve access and promote safety, which will lead to improved academic achievement. Our recommendations should be completed by February of this year. We feel strongly that student support services are vital to the achievement of all students, as well as closing the achievement gap. Developing behavioral and academic interventions, collaborating with agencies, and improving physical, emotional, and social well-being are imperative to the success of Minnesota students. The members of the Student Services Coalition work cooperatively across discipline to address the needs of each student within the diverse school districts. Therefore, we also promote the differentiated level of support services to meet the needs of individual schools and the individual districts, i.e. local control. Student support services are vital to the academic and social achievement of students. Our goal this year is to improve the access to these services for every student in Minnesota. Thank you for your time. We appreciate your support.
Thank you. And members who are new to the committee, it's very big that we didn't hear from all five of those professions, that they are united in a common agenda this year is new, and we appreciate it. Charlie Kite.
Good afternoon. As you hear one quick presentation after another, I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. The largest group of people in our association are the school superintendents that are, in my opinion, of course, the most cuddly and lovable people in all of education in Minnesota. Let me just precede my remarks by saying very quickly that as we continue to strive together to try to have globally competitive schools, it will not work to only lay all of the accountability and all the responsibility on the schools and the people who work in the schools. We have to have everybody pulling together, and we need to be looking at places where we can incent the students themselves and the parents to be pulling with us. When the students and the parents are saying, we want more because there's some carrot out there, the schools will respond and we'll all get better together. That said, our highest priorities from our association, the first one that you've heard repeated several times already today, is we need enough money to operate. And I know you all but gag on everybody asking you for more money, but the reality is the schools are still reeling from 3 and 4 years ago when we went with zero and zero, and even though there was some redress made after that, we're still behind the curve, and that's been very difficult for us. Second thing we'd like to say, and this, I'm repeating Scott Kronquist to a degree, and that's that there are huge problems financially in the area of special education. The appropriation is capped, and we're struggling to meet those costs. Remember that Minnesota passed the special education law 2 years before the federal government passed theirs. This is a shared responsibility of both the state and the federal government. So we need to get that fixed. We will bring forward a couple of pieces of legislation that will also include some strategies to level the cost somewhat so that some districts don't have extraordinarily high costs and others slightly more moderate costs. We'll bring you some strategies on that. In regard to the achievement gap, there are several things that can be done. We'll bring forward two pieces of legislation that we think can actually make a significant difference. And neither of them is out of the world expensive. The first one will be a proposal to incent a number of our schools to look at a year-round school calendar. Not a longer calendar, but a year-round calendar. Simply changing the rhythm of how the children go to school helps the poorest kids even more than it helps the upper middle class kids. And you can reduce the achievement gap simply by making a change. We're going to try to encourage you to have about 50 schools in the state of Minnesota be incented to try that idea. The second thing that we'll bring legislation forward on is to encourage you to put money into the K to second grade specter to try to head off as many kids as possible from going into special ed. When we put our children into special ed at grade 3, they go in and they never come out, and it's very expensive. If we can get 1, 2, 3, or 4% of those kids never to go in the first place, we'll pay long-term benefits, and for a concentrated investment at those ages, we think we can have a lot more kids not going into special ed. So those are some things that we would bring forward to you as initiatives that would help with the achievement gap. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Elaine Keith. Oops. John, I'm glad you came up here, John, because obviously this little print is way too much for me. Elaine is next with two different clients, but okay. John Hoffman first. Apologies for that.
Elaine, welcome. Thanks for letting me cut in front of you. Madam Chair, members of the K-12 Finance Division, good afternoon. My name is John Hoffman, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Coalition of Children with Disabilities. The coalition is made up of the Pacer Center, where I work, the Arc of Minnesota, the Autism Society of Minnesota, United Cerebral Palsy of Minnesota, the Epilepsy Foundation, the Minnesota Disability Law Center, the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, and the Upper Midwest Branch of the International Dyslexia Association. Through its membership and direct advocacy, the coalition is in close touch with parents, self-advocates, and professionals. Through their collective experiences as parents and advocates, the coalition is able to work for solutions to address problems and concerns specifically related to special education. I am also the parent of a young girl who lives with spina bifida. She's an example of what the spirit and intent of special ed and early intervention set out to accomplish in getting to the achievement gap. We were told after her birth by doctors and specialists that she probably wouldn't walk and expect her to struggle with education. Because of our advocacy and the partnering and collaboration of the school system, my daughter now is a fully included fourth grader who participates with accommodations. She takes piano and voice and is an advanced reader. Therefore, my comments are from two perspectives. Number one, I am a parent, and number two, I represent the Coalition of Children with Disabilities. I would like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk to you about the achievement gap and specifically what that means to children with disabilities and their special health care needs in Minnesota. As you know, prior to the federal mandate of 1975, Minnesota had a historical evidence of being a leader in educating students with disabilities. Matter of fact, in 1957, Minnesota passed a law that provided mandatory special education for students ages 5 to 21 who had IQ scores of 50 or above. Similarly, at that time, there were over 250,000 children in the United States living in institutions. There was 4 million children who weren't getting equal access to a free, appropriate public education. Matter of fact, there was over 1 million children that weren't even allowed access into our public school buildings. Minnesota demonstrated its commitment to students with disabilities long before Congress established the Education of All Handicapped Children's Act of 1975, now known as the Individuals with Disability Education Act. Minnesota's strong tradition of supporting youth with disabilities is impressive when you hold it up to the rest of the country. However, I think we as a state, in order to address the achievement gap, not only must continue our strong tradition of excellence, but we must increase our investment in ensuring that the achievement gap for children with disabilities is diminished. We are so far behind right now. The state proration of funds to districts has slipped from a promised 68% of salary costs to 50%. Overall, cross-subsidy, as you know, is forecasted to reach $630 million by 2009. Putting this much financial pressure on local school districts is creating an adverse environment for all children to learn in. Adequately funding special ed is the Coalition of Children with Disabilities' main objective this year and will help the achievement of all students and close the achievement gap specifically for children with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Elaine Keith. Try to keep track of this agenda now. And Elaine, you have 3 and 3 for your two topics.
Thank you. 3 and 3 sounds good, Madam Chair. Okay. First, I'll don my library hat. Madam Chair and members, I'm Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association, whose members are library staff, library board members, and library supporters, and also the Minnesota Educational Media Organization, known as MEMO, whose members are school librarians and also school technology coordinators. We have a joint legislative platform which is being passed around, and I serve as the lobbyist for both of those organizations. The first item on the platform is an increase in regional library basic system support, and that is the main source of state funding for public libraries. It's essentially our general ed formula. And this appropriation has been pretty flat for a long time. The last significant increase was 16 years ago. It was passed in the 1991 session. And 8 years later, in 1999, there was a small increase. There were some smaller grant programs that went to libraries that were rolled into this, and a very small amount of new money was put in on top of it, about 3%. So basically, in the last 16 years, public library funding from the state has increased only 3%. And during that time, library usage has skyrocketed. And even in areas where the population has declined, our public libraries have seen substantial increases in their usage. And so this has put a lot of pressure on our budgets. In some places, cities and counties have stepped up to provide more funding. But in the last few years, that's been difficult for them because of cuts in state aid to cities and counties and because of pressure to keep down property taxes, which is where the bulk of our funding comes from. The result is that our public libraries have seen substantial budget cuts, and you probably have seen some of the stories in the media and seen it in your own communities. Libraries have had to lay off staff, in some cases close branches, and not just in Minneapolis. They've had to cut their book budgets. They've had to cut their hours. They've eliminated summer reading programs for kids, reduced their bookmobile service, and put off upgrading obsolete public access computers. Our libraries are very heavily used in Minnesota. Typically, nationwide, we rank near the top in library usage, but in terms of library funding, we're closer to the middle. We really make very efficient use of our limited dollars, but we're really stretched very, very thinly, and so we are hoping that you can help us out this session. And that is the number one item for us this session. I want to talk very quickly, well, I guess next I do want to address the achievement gap, because I do think that public libraries have a role to play there. We provide internet access to students who don't have that at home. We foster literacy for preschoolers through story times and providing storybooks, and for K-12 students who don't have a reading-rich environment at home. And lastly, by providing a place, a safe place, for students to get help with research projects and with their general homework outside of school hours. The next two items on our platform, because I was told to talk 1 to 3, I'm going to talk about together because they really are one and the same. We have two separate funding streams, one for schools and one for public libraries, but they both go to fund the high-speed telecommunications network that we share. And that was begun with an appropriation from the legislature back in 1995. For those of you who were around then, you may remember the TAG grants. Later, those funding streams were split apart, one for schools, one for libraries, but they still go to support the common network that we share. And this network provides our internet access for students, teachers, library staff, and the public. It's what we run our library catalogs on. It provides our ITV connections for distance learning, and much, much more. And it's really become very vital to our schools and public libraries. We really couldn't live without it. We're asking for additional funds to upgrade that network because the demands on it keep increasing, and more and more of our services depend on the operation of that network, and because the costs are so disparate from place to place around the state, and those disparities are really outside of the control of the individual schools and public libraries. They really are accidents of geography. And so we look forward to working with you on those priorities this session. Okay, now I'm going to take off my library hat and put on my school nutrition hat. Again, I'm Elaine Keefe, Madam Chair, and I represent the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. Charlie Kite likes to say that my agenda is read and feed. And the School Nutrition Association is made up of school cooks, dietitians, nutrition directors, and cafeteria servers. And our top priority this year is an increase in school lunch funding, very, very basic. The vast majority of our school districts have a very difficult time covering the cost of a school lunch through the traditional combination of the student payments, federal funds, and state funds. Schools in Minnesota, according to the latest figures we have from the Department of Ed, lose an average of 43 cents for every school lunch that they serve. And school boards, as you might imagine, expect their nutrition programs to break even. They're supposed to be self-supporting. Years ago, actually, when I first started representing school nutrition programs here, which was in 1991, I often heard from members who had previously served on their school boards who said, oh, we purposely, you know, keep the lunch price low so it can be accessible to as many students as possible. We know they'll run a deficit, and we plan to make that up from our general fund. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. School boards really expect our programs to be self-sufficient. And so they don't want to have to cover a deficit in the food service fund by taking money out of their general fund. That takes money out of the classroom. And so schools make that gap, that 43-cent gap up between the cost of producing a school lunch and the revenues that they bring in by selling individual food items in the a la carte line. And unfortunately, the most popular selling items tend to be those that are of minimal nutritional value. They're things like bags of chips, cupcakes, etc. Additional state funding can really help us to reduce our dependence on the a la carte sales and also enable us to upgrade the nutritional content of our meals by providing more expensive but more nutritious items like fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and the like. School meals address the achievement gap by ensuring that every child has access to good nutrition and comes into the classroom ready to learn. I'm sure you've heard hungry children can't learn, and it really is true, and it's backed up by many, many research studies. We look forward to working with you on that issue this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Roger Arnson. Also representing two clients, so you get the three and three.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll spare you the second introduction. It'll still be me. My name is Roger Arnson. I represent the Elementary School Principals Association and the Secondary School Principals Association. I did bring along some copies of our legislative platforms here, which you may want to take a look at and which I think we've sent to all of you as well. And the instruction that we received from Ms. Patrick via the chair was which portions of your legislative agenda are linked to student achievement and how are they linked. Obviously, our number one goal is all day, every day kindergarten with the elementary principals, and I might say that the secondary principals strongly support that as well. Both groups view that as one of the major reforms that is simply on the shelf just waiting for to be funded that we could implement and see some definite results. And I know that you've heard that several times here today. I might say that this is the 26th legislative session that I've worked here at the Capitol. And frankly, as you look at the 22 groups that are on your list there, there is not very often that we disagree a lot about things. We do on some issues. But it appears to me that all of the groups are joining in and telling us and telling you that all day, every day K is something that we need to do. And we know that we heard from the governor today about how much it costs. It's $320 million over the 2 years with their various estimates. It's worth it. And we ought to spend it. And we need to find a way to get you folks to support that as well. A few other initiatives that you'll see as you sit here in the committee this year. We're strongly committed to staff development for teachers and for principals, and feel that this is critical about student achievement. This is where it's going to happen, is in the classroom, that we need staff development for our teachers. We support the mandatory set-aside of school revenue for staff development, and in addition, last year we began a very interesting program with the department and the University of Minnesota called the Principals Academy. We adopted a plan for training school principals that has a very strong curriculum staff development component to it. It costs about $12,000 a person. We put $800,000 into this a couple years ago. We're advised that this is going to appear in the governor's budget when it comes for your review, and we'll be back talking to you about how much we support that. I might say as well, it's a nice time to appear before you after the governor's speech and some of the initiatives that he had as well. Today's kind of the day when we come in and tell you all the things that we support. We will come back and talk to you as well from time to time about things that we don't support. And I can tell you that from 10 to 1 till now, I did receive a couple calls from principals about one full year of college as a requirement of graduating from high school, and that would be something that the secondary principals wouldn't support. We strongly support the College in the Schools program that you folks saw a little tinge of last year about the teaching requirements for continuing that, and not a deal was cut, but Minsky was forced to see the light by some members about what the training would be, and we think that's an important program, but we don't think that would be a good program if it was mandated for every 12th grader in Minnesota. So, Madam Chair and members, we look forward to working with you, and we share your enthusiasm for this excellent time of what we can do for kids in Minnesota schools. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Thank you very much. And we do have Fred Storty, I see, in the audience there, too, who is the Executive Director of the Elementary School Principals, if you want to raise your hand so people can get your face. Thank you. The next person, if I can get this one in order, is Ron Solberg. He makes it easy for me. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Solberg. I'm an employee of the Duluth School District, but I also lobby for the Lake Superior Area School Districts. And today I'll be giving a brief presentation on the Lake Superior Area School District's legislative platform. The Duluth platform is still in the print shop, so you're in luck. I'll have to hand that out to you separately.
We'll get that from Representative Murphy later.
The Lake Superior Area School Districts extend from Grand Marais down through Moose Lake, and most of the school districts are not members of the range, although two of them are. Most of our school districts are suffering declining enrollment, although two aren't. Most of our school districts have very low operating referendum, and some of them have no operating referendum, have not been able to pass a referendum. And most of the rationale for that, I think, is it has to do with low valuation. So the school districts, some of them are in statutory operating debt or close to statutory operating debt, and have had a lot of trouble trying to maintain programs in the face of declining enrollment and flat funding over the last several years. Even so, a number of our districts have taken different approaches to try to close the learning gap in the students in their schools. And I was asked to talk briefly about a couple of those. I know one school district, Proctor in particular, along with a partnership with Hermantown School District, has worked very hard on the early childhood programs in order to try to help those schools. Vocational education is a very important program for a lot of our schools, school districts, and they do this in cooperation, very good cooperation with their area businesses. Four-year-old transition kindergarten program, the one that is generally attributed to Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have three school districts that have had that program and have struggled to maintain them as funding has fallen away, but they found that very important to try to get their kids up to speed by the time they can get to the regular classroom programs with other students. And also, all of our school districts try to provide at least one all-day kindergarten program. Haven't been able to expand that program anywhere to the degree that they'd like to, but they support that a great deal. And with that, I'll stop, and I'll be glad to go over each one of these items with you in as great a detail as you'd like as the session progresses.
Thank you very much. I don't see Todd Otis. Is there someone here for him, or should we move on? I guess so. Brad Lundell. Actually, there you are. Okay. I know some of these people said they wanted to be after 3 o'clock, but I guess we're now after 3 o'clock, so welcome.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, when you said, there you are, I thought you meant Todd Otis. didn't know what to do. But members of the committee, Madam Chair, my name is Brad Lundell. I'm the Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education. We're a 58-member consortium of school districts located both in the metro and non-metro areas. Organized originally around the principle of shared principle of low property wealth per pupil unit, and the difficulties that were accompanied those school districts as they tried to use the property tax to augment both building and operational funds through voter-approved levies. Our top priority this year in Schools for Equity and Education, you probably heard about it, many of you have attended the policy fora that we've had prior to the legislative session, is the PS Minnesota efforts. And we've invested a lot of time and energy over the last few years dealing with comprehensive reform. We do believe it's time for comprehensive reform of the education funding system. We will be visiting with many of you throughout the session, talking about what some of those reforms might look like. We realize that it's the whole combo platter, so we realize that it's a very large appetite to take all of it as once, and I think that we are trying to find ways where we can create a framework for some long-term reform and also look for ways to start moving down that road. But that is our number one priority, and we certainly want to try, as we move forward this year, to gauge many of the proposals that will be coming forward. It was a little problematic today when I heard the governor's State of the State address talking about pilot projects again. One of our issues is why have a pilot project when you should be trying to get everybody on the plane? And so I think that's what we're trying to look at this year, is looking for all kids and getting all kids up to standards in a standards-based funding system. Our next priority probably relates to special education. It's, again, part of what we've done in PS Minnesota. But special education, you know, clearly, if it's not remedied, the shortfalls in funding that are not remedied there, we're going to see greater and greater cross-subsidies. And that cross-subsidy, if nothing changes, I believe, by the department's own statistics, goes up to over $600 million in fiscal 2009. So I think we need to really do some things in special ed. Clearly, that's a place where we have left behind during the last budget cycle, as it simply did not get the kind of inflationary growth that was going elsewhere. And again, a dollar in special ed is a dollar in the formula, not in each district, but clearly we've got needs out there that need to be addressed. Schools for Equity and Education, as I said, and I'm looking right at Representative Marquardt, because we're probably going to be talking to him quite a bit as well. We kind of organized around property taxes one of our issues, and the difficulty in many districts of using the property tax, or the sensitivity in those districts to higher property taxes. And one of the problems that we've had over the years in Schools for Equity and Education is that our white hat turns beige, because people say you're using classroom dollars to buy down property taxes, and that's been problematic for us. I think that we would like to see dollars for the school levies not being pitted against school operational needs. We think that taxpayers clearly in many districts, especially districts that are using it, property wealth for both building and for operational purposes, gets to be very, very high property tax burdens. We would like to see the property tax reform, but again, have that come as a kind of a discussion between the education and property tax funding divisions and trying to find where best that those dollars should come from, because I think it doesn't serve anyone well in the long run to have these kinds of dollars pitted against all-day kindergarten dollars, for instance. I'm looking at Representative Swells when I say that. So I guess you two can fight that one out. But that would be, other than that, I think if you look at our list of priorities, it's a lot like most everyone else's. I think that the all-day kindergarten, we have a number of school districts in our organization that are interested in the all-day kindergarten and certainly want to support those things as well.
Thank you very much. Mary Doherty.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert, and I do represent Mary Doherty Gilbert. I grandfather everybody, and I went back to my old name.
I wondered about that card down here.
No, it's fine. You're all grandfathered in. I represent the St. Paul Public Schools, and I've actually had the pleasure of representing the St. Paul Public Schools since, it's hard to admit, since 1987. And our school district has changed significantly over that period that I work with them. When I started, I think we were about 35% minority, and in kind of the general range for free and reduced lunch. And currently, we have 30% Asian Americans, nearly 30% black, 26.5% white, 12.5% Hispanic, and nearly 2% Native American Indian. And we think it's a wonderfully diverse student population in our district that we have embraced. We've also, in the last couple of years, when I first started, we were dealing with the first wave of immigrants from Vietnam and Laos, the Hmong immigrants. And lately, we've had kind of a second wave of new immigrants. We've had over 1,000 families and students that have enrolled that have come from the camps that have closed in Thailand. We've had a big influx in Burmese students, and then, of course, the political situation in Africa, we've had quite a few new immigrants in between Somalia and Ethiopia as well. Our total enrollment is over 42,000. We kind of bounce between the first, second, and third size district over the years I've represented them. Now we're second behind Anoka. 41% of our students, or 17,000 of them, are limited English proficient. So roughly 45% of our kindergarten class come to school without skills necessary to or need some kind of limited English proficiency services. 70% of our population, or 29,000 of our students, are eligible for free and reduced lunch. So what we have seen happen over the last several years is our population has become significantly more problems with economics, poverty, mobility, housing has been an issue, as along with the language issues. Over the last several years, we've instituted a lot of reforms that have proven some success. And in your handout, I have given you a reference guide for the district, which does recap some of our summary testing information that we've had over the last couple of years. And it shows that we have made some dramatic improvements, both on the MCAs and the Stanford test. We use the Stanford test because when Dr. Harvey was here and we were instituting our reforms, we wanted to be able to compare ourselves to other districts in the country to see how we were measuring up. And so we hope, though, over the switch with the MCAs, that we can limit the number of days and the number of testing we do, and we hope that we can move just to the MCAs, that it'll give us the information that we need. We've started the program for academic excellence, and Dr. Heistad talked about that yesterday, about having some of the balanced literacy proposals in place, along with the early kindergarten initiatives, have been key to some of the success. We've ended social promotion. We've instituted site-based management and budgeting. We've opened and operate a leadership institute to grow teachers and administrators in St. Paul, which has made a big difference in the cadre of folks that we have moving into the assistant principal and principal positions. And we've significantly changed our delivery system for our English language learners. And I just want to hold up a graph. Our district was recognized nationally, and this is us right there. And this is third grade math. And this is a district that was recognized compared to the nation in closing the achievement gap. So that's third grade. What's more impressive, though, is all of us have had incredible growth in the elementary years. It seems like even Gates has realized that dealing with secondary reform and high school reform, those are really difficult issues to tackle. This is our achievement growth in seventh grade. Just to show you that we've been able to sustain some of that. The reforms that we put in place seem to be paying some dividends over time as these cohorts move through the district. And you can see, compared to some of the other districts, 13 is San Diego, they've actually increased the achievement gap during that period. And I'd be happy to share any of these with you, but if I copy them in black and white paper, you couldn't really tell what the graphs mean. So. The other issue that we have is we do have an incredibly mobile population. About 22% of our kids move. They just turn over. And so that's why we feel like working with the rest of the state and the other districts is so important for us, because those kids end up coming to us. We end up sending those kids to other districts. And so as far as the top key issues, we think it's really important that you fund some of the things you already require us to do. And last year you passed the new math and science standards. We clearly need more resources if we're going to meet the new standards, particularly at the secondary level. Our students need more time to master Algebra 1, Algebra 2, Physics, or Calculus. When we looked at Washington Junior, where they set the goal to have all, it was a middle school, to have all of the eighth graders have Algebra 1, they had to double the amount of time they spent on math. Well, if you have, I don't know if you have middle school kids, I do, and I'd like to give them away right now, but you can't just beat the daylights out of them with math and science. If you want to keep them engaged in schools, you know, you have to still be able to allow them the opportunity to do the math and the recreational activity and the science, or I'm sorry, besides math and science, art and music and languages. And band, or participate in sports, or do some of the inquiry stuff that's so important for middle school kids, so you have them thinking that high school might be okay for them. And so we need to be able to have our kids spend more time on math and science without having them give up all the other basics. In addition to the time, the high schools, and I think everyone probably will tell you that the high schools are overcrowded. The class sizes are too big. I think it's probably the single biggest issue. So imagine yourself trying to teach 40 kids each hour, where half of them don't speak English, algebra, and calculus. And the curriculum, frankly, between when we were in school, it's changed. It is much more difficult than it was when we were in school.
30 seconds.
Okay. The second would be, and I think everybody's talked about that already, again, the requirements we have in place, special education, English language learners, and the investment in the early childhood programs. And please, please, don't make us do anything new. Mm-hmm. We have our hands full.
Thank you very much. Jim Grathwall.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwall representing Minneapolis Schools, and we've reached the point in the agenda where Roger Aronson would like to say, everything's been said, but it hasn't been said by everyone.
Yeah.
And I guess we should go in twice on Mary Gilbert's middle school kids. Do we have any takers? No? Okay. So I'm going to take a little, since we have covered a lot of ground on initiatives that are going to come before you, and you've heard the broad coalition of educators and education interest groups talk, I'd really like to take a different tack on this and remind you the Tale of Two Cities begins with it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And I think that applies to us in K-12 finance and in anyone concerned about children and performance and achievement. And I want to talk about another gap, and that's the gap between the education system, the K-12 system, we articulate that we all want, and I'm not going to separate legislators, policymakers from interest groups, and the one we are willing to afford, the one we are willing to finance. And the legislative agenda I'll be bringing to you, and I think most of the people in the room, would be summarized as, we encourage you to to have the courage of your convictions. You've campaigned on this, you've door-knocked on this, you've heard at the in the town meetings and across the state what's going on in classrooms, and we are operating in a new world where the targets we are setting are universal achievement. That's what No Child Left Behind is. For those of you who want to call for more accountability, I'm sorry, you've been preempted by the federal government. Universal proficiency by 2014. The only way you can trump that is by, do I hear 2013, 2012, 2011. So that's a new world. And so I'd encourage you to finance the things we know are going to get us there. And I had to duck in and out of yesterday's hearing, but, you know, I love Dr. David Heistad. I love those videos he showed you. I've seen them before. And I like to say that when you look at that, I believe you can actually hear the achievement gap closing when you look at what our teachers can do. The issue here, then, is replicating that success and making that the standard. So invest in early childhood. Invest in us. Keep putting the right teachers in front of the right kids. Invest in the staff development so all of our teachers come to us with those skills. And, you know, they're not getting them out of their post-secondary institutions. Invest in, as Ben said, the special education. You know, we all want to provide a free and appropriate public education. And right now, when you look at that special ed cross-subsidy and where that's projected to go, there's just no better testament to the difference or the gap in the education system we want and the education we're willing to afford, and we are stripping marrow from the bone internally to fund the services mandated, and we get sued if we don't provide. No one sues us if we lose BAN or the second language or language at the elementary level. So I'd encourage you to have the courage of your convictions. Fund, you know, and let me just say one last thing. In terms, we may have some discussion or interest around desegregation, and that's another mandate that we're invested in and we want to deliver on. But if we put everything on, and this has been mentioned earlier, if we put everything on the doorsteps of school and we don't have the courage to address kind of institutional racism in housing, transportation, employment, health care, opportunities to access the justice system, we'll make very little progress. Maybe I'll look at my notes and see if I've covered it all. But if you look at the data, and the report your staff have prepared and you've been briefed on shows real declines in state aid over the past several years, real increases in homestead property taxes. We are, homeowners are paying more, and they're getting less in terms of class size, in terms of programmatic options at their high school. And it feels like it's an expect more, pay less world, where we're setting higher standards. The governor now wants us to deliver a year of college in K-12, and we don't have the resources yet to do, as Ms. Gilbert said, the stuff you've already mandated. So I would encourage you to have the courage of your convictions. Finance the public education system you want to see. And it's a little bit like, I'll date myself with a popular program of the 70s. Was it $7 million man, $1 million man? We have the technology to close the gap. All we need to do is invest in what we know works, which has been articulated already, and we can do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Dennis Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Denny Carlson. I'm Assistant Superintendent for the Anoka-Hennepin Schools. And I won't be the day-to-day person here. Valerie Doslin, who represents other clients as well, but is our day-to-day person here. And if you need anything, ask Valerie for help. Anoka-Hennepin is the state's largest school district. We have 40,000 students. We also graduate the most kids in the state and have for several years. We're about 5% of the state in terms of education K-12 students. We have 22% free and reduced kids and about 18% diversity. You should be getting a copy of the Anoka-Hennepin platform. I'll hit some of the highlights. We need tax relief. Our top priority, John Hoffman, who spoke before in representing PACER, is one of our school board members. We need tax relief because we have a $40 million levy coming up in the fall of 2007. And if we don't, if that levy does not pass, we will cut $40 million from the Anoka-Hennepin budget. So we need tax relief. Secondly, we need $14 million every year or we cut. We need $14 million of new money every year to make the operating budget point that others have made. That's a yearly amount. It's about 4%. Usually it's about 3% on salaries and about 1% on benefits. And if we don't get that $14 million, we cut. So we need at least $200-$250 on the formula each of the 2 years. In addition to that, as many have mentioned, special ed, our cross subsidy for special ed is $20 million a year. So we need some help in special ed, and that would get us between those three things, tax relief, stable funding with $200-$250 on the formula, and a little bit for special ed, that would get us the $14 million we need so we wouldn't have to cut once we pass the levy. In addition to that, I would say technology funding is essential. You can't close the achievement gap without testing. You can't do testing without technology. And we need some money for both hardware and software and help in the technology area. We have early education and all-day kindergarten on our platform. That has not helped with the $14 million gap. If you decide to fund that or a portion of that, that is a new program which takes new money above and beyond the $14 million. Beyond that, I would say we also, and you've helped us in the past, with a compensatory grant. The current formula does not work for Anoka-Hennepin. We've had 1 year of study. The University of Minnesota has helped us with that study. It's promising, and we'd like that continued in the next year or two as well. With that, Madam Chair, I will finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much
for doing this. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. And then Valerie Doslin is here with another client as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin, and in addition to working with the Anoka-Hennepin School District, I also represent the intermediate school districts. And they are three very unique school districts in the metropolitan area, one in the West Metro, one in the East Metro, and one in the North Metro, in the South Metro. And they are made up of membership of individual school districts who belong to the intermediate school district. And the role of the intermediate school district is to serve as a service provider to the member districts. Their primary function is in the area of special education and career and technical education, although they do a number of other unique opportunities and services to their member school districts. I just wanted to also let you know that intermediates don't have general revenue dollars or levy authority like regular school districts do. Their funds are received from member fees from their member school districts, as well as from tuition billing for career and technical education, as well as special education. Just very briefly, some of the things that some of the students that the intermediates serve, some things to remember about them is the students often require a more hands-on, practical approach. Many of them have severe disabilities. A lot of the students served by the intermediates are the low-incidence, high-need students with disabilities. The students need someone familiar with their learning challenges so that instruction can be adapted and learning can be successful for those students. The students often need therapeutic measures integrated as part of their learning activities. And the learning groups often need to be a lot smaller in their learning environment than what we see in a regular K-12 school district. Often, intermediate school districts have their own facilities that provide their services, but other cases, the intermediates provide services as part of their member school districts. For instance, in Representative Morgan's district, there is an elementary school that provides deaf and hard of hearing classrooms, two classrooms, within a school district that's part of the Burnsville School District. A couple of the priorities that you'll be hearing from the intermediates about this year. The first priority is the ability to access the Safe Schools Levy. The intermediates do not have access to that. The individual school districts do. The Safe Schools Levy would be used for the same purposes that the intermediates have or regular school districts have access to. But some things to consider about the students, they do serve a high population of students with emotionally behaviorally disturbed. And hopefully during the session, you'll be able to see a video that the intermediates have presented on that need. And other things that we'll be coming to the legislature for, one is the access to the lease levy to help the intermediates provide for their facilities. And then another one, which will come before this committee, is alternative compensation. School districts hire teachers the same way regular school districts do, but the current alternative compensation program doesn't allow them to generate the revenue so that they can participate in the alternative compensation program. And you'll see I'm a familiar face around the Capitol, so feel free to stop by and stop me in the hallways and ask me if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Next we have Nancy Farnham, and then I see that Todd Otis is here, so we'll swing back to him for our concluding speaker. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you. I want to say thanks to Todd for coming in, so I'm not the last one on the agenda today. But you'll be pleased to know I've been scratching out notes like crazy because I'm sure it's been a long afternoon. But good afternoon to all of you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Farnham, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Learning Resource Center. So thank you for inviting me today. Many of you are familiar with the MLRC and the track record we've established with getting kids ready to learn in public schools across the state. Our legislative priority is to continue to implement state-of-the-art, affordable, and replicable classroom interventions designed to increase the academic achievement in children statewide. For those of you new to the committee, the MLRC was established by the state legislature back in 1999 with the mission of assuring the success of early mastery, foundational readiness, and academic skills for the later grades. We accomplish this by training and mentoring teachers through a three-year model, and Minnesota schools have benefited greatly from ongoing legislative support in that area. Since 1999, the MLRC has worked with 86 public schools across the state of Minnesota and trained and mentored nearly 900 teachers within those schools. As you can see from the MLRC fact sheet map I've shared, our work has touched the lives of some 14,000 Minnesota students in elementary schools that we label as smart schools. The average cost per student over the past 7 years, when we take the legislative allocation and divide it by the number of students we're working with, is $109. Very affordable, especially when compared to costs associated with special ed services. The brain stimulation interventions we use have been developed over the past 10 years by New Visions School, which is an inner-city charter school serving 200 students annually. The three interventions were developed to close what we refer to as learning readiness gaps. The interventions, which are known as SMART, neurotechnology, and an auditory stimulation program are all designed to stimulate the child's brain in order for it to function at its most efficient level. And I'd very much like to meet with all of you individually to share more information on the specific programs, but they combine activities, technology, and ways, again, to stimulate the brain in order to prepare it to learn. We address issues such as academic skills, but also attention and the rising number of emotional and behavior issues that challenge so many of our students in schools today. Just quickly, the teacher training model that we employ by the MLRC is based on a 3-year relationship, and that starts when a team of teachers come to one of our 3 or 4 day MLRC workshops, and that connects the current brain research with its practical application in the classroom. Following that, an MLRC mentor works with the school for 3 years in helping them to implement the program and also for them to carry it forward once that model has been completed. And again, that has all been supported through legislative funding over the past 7 years. Interest in the MLRC programs continue to grow each year. Right now, in January, we have 7 schools on the waiting list for next year, and based on inquiries I'm getting, I'm expecting that that will double. In addition, many of our current SMART schools have expressed an interest in expanding the programs within their school and adding grade levels as well. Just a little bit on the data, and again, this would be something I'd be more than willing to share additional information in the future, but we have had remarkable data over the past 7 years. From 2004-05, just 2 highlights. We had 418 Minnesota kindergarten students that year who had spent 1 year in the SMART program. At the end of the year, 2 of 3 tested above the national means for early reading skills when measured on the nationally recognized and normed Metropolitan Readiness Test. In that same year, we had 725 SMART first and second graders who tested 9 out of 10 scoring normal or above in the SORT reading test. Finally, the MLRC has gained national recognition. After hearing of our Minnesota work, the U.S. Department of Education chose to provide 2 major grants for replication of the SMART program in schools across the nation. As a result, the total number of SMART schools state and nationwide now exceeds 200, spanning 13 states across the nation. The success of the SMART program show it can markedly change the lives of all children, including those who are disadvantaged, by preparing them to learn and thereby bringing dramatic change to public education. We would very much appreciate your support and request reinstatement of the full $250,000 per year over the next biennium.
Thank you very much. And
Todd Otis is next, and before everybody rushes off the minute he leaves, there was one optional person, Stacia Smith from the Chamber of Commerce, who is here and asked if she could have her time as she put in the option for her, should she show up, and she is here. So Todd Otis and then Stacia Smith. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was late, but I appreciate the chance to testify. My name is Todd Otis. I'm president of Ready for K, which is an early childhood advocacy group, 5 years old. And this is Eric Hauge, who's helping our legislative and lobbying efforts. Many of you may know him from having been an aide to Senator Hottinger. Thank you for the chance to be here. I think it's so great that you are making the link between early childhood and K-12. One of the main messages I come with you today for trying to deliver to you is early education is that, and birth to 5, they're learning from birth. The linkage is one of the things we're working on at Ready for K, how we can better connect the world of early childhood at K-12. So the policy proposals that we've formulated are being handed out right now. Our goal is really to try to move the needle on school readiness. The Department of Education has come out with a study several years ago showing that fewer than half the kids are fully prepared for kindergarten. And so our mission is simple, if challenging, to try to move that from 50% of the kids ready to 80% by 2012. And why should that matter to K-12 education? One of the main benefits for doing early childhood right is improving the ability of K-12 to perform itself. I'll give you a few facts that are illustrative of that. One is children with high-quality early learning experiences are 40% less likely to need special education or be held back a grade. That's a big number. Children from low-income families who participate in high-quality early learning childhood education programs show the most benefits. They repeat fewer grades and learn at higher levels. And one of the most startling facts that I also wanted to share is a child who enters school reading below grade level has only a 1 in 8 chance of catching up. So these early years are critically important. And we've put together a policy proposal that starts with parents. Parents have to be at the center of any kind of solution to this. And you'll see it in the handout. We've broken it into 6 bills that you'll be seeing in different versions throughout the session. One supporting parents at home, including early home visiting, nurses visiting in particularly targeted or challenged families, and trying to expand ECFE back to the level it can be and have that reach out more effectively to communities. So the early years are critical years, and we want to enhance parents' ability to make those good years. We're also advocating funding really high-quality early childhood programs because it really matters. A study done by the Department of Human Services a couple of years ago showed that children in accredited child care centers, and maybe only 15% of the child care centers are accredited, they're really high quality. Those kids, when they were tested with the same school readiness instrument that the state used to determine overall school readiness, their numbers were up at 75 or 80% school ready, almost twice as good as the statewide average. So that showed quality really counts, but it also costs, and so part of our challenge is to figure out how do we invest in a targeted way at at-risk kids with really quality programs. That's the second bill. In terms of this committee, the third bill is E12 linkages, and we've got a couple of ideas we really hope to share with you in greater depth later. One is creating hubs, early childhood K-12 hubs within schools in which parents and providers can come both for programming, information, and connections with the K-12 world. So both sides know what to expect, and we're going to try to propose some pilots for early childhood hubs that link to the K-12 system. Also, an exciting model that was done in the city of Chicago, age 3 to grade 3. This is a way of bringing all the kids together in a kind of a new configuration so that the same overall program is administered from starting with age 3 through grade 3. That's where you really have a quality experience that can then last through third grade, and we'll be proposing that as well. We'd like to improve the quality of the early childhood professionals, and you'll see that on the back page of our handout, as well as enhancing and replenishing the child care cuts that have been made, but with a twist of even more quality. It's got to be quality if you're going to have it have an impact on school readiness. So we think Art Rolnick of the 9th Federal Reserve District is right. We think it's the single best public investment we can make. Currently, early childhood gets 1% of the Minnesota state budget. Our ambitious goal is to move to 2%. That adds up to a lot of money when you do the math, but it's money that we think, if it's well spent, will have real benefits in terms of the workforce, in terms of K-12 performance, less crime, more prosperity. And with that, thank you again for making this connection, and we look forward to an ongoing working relationship with you.
Thank you very much. And then finally, Stacia Smith.
Hi, thanks for sticking me at the end here, Madam Chair and members. My name is Stacia Smith, but I go by Stacia. Stacy, trust me, anything works for me. Just wanted to let you know I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and we also lobby in education issues, early ed, K-12, and higher education. We represent over 1,600 businesses in Minnesota. And a couple of things I was thinking about that kind of tie into the achievement gap as requested are that we support rigorous math standards for all students, and that every student needs to be held to a high level of expectation in order for all students to be able to compete after they graduate in a global economy, what we're all facing. Second, that accountability systems should stay in place, statewide testing, that sort of thing, and so that schools are reporting their progress to the public, and performance expectations for schools should be equal among all schools. Changing expectations based on income or race is really a disservice to those schools. All students need to be prepared to compete in global economy, as I mentioned. And finally, we support school choice so that students can go to whichever school is going to best fit his or her needs. We think that's very important. So I look forward to meeting you all individually if I haven't already, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Members, we'll see you tomorrow. Meeting's adjourned.